This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Yes, dear listeners, with 2 weeks before the election, we really have got a problem here. But like the lead singer from the legendary group The Waitresses and my personal favorite song from 1982, we've all got to push back and say no to the idea that we're going to throw up our hands and quit. Quite the contrary. It's time to dig in. We'll be discussing some details about maybe how we need to dig in our second segment today, with a couple of our favorite lawyers. Stephen J. Harper will come back to give us more of his diagnostics about what's going on, and we'll hear from our friend Nancy Yamada, an activist lawyer who has some notions about how it is we're not going to quit. We have 2 weeks to the election, that's for sure, and I got to tell you that yours truly is still literally losing sleep over this. For his part, Edward McMillan says he's been sleeping like a baby. Of course, that may be enhanced by the kava-kava he's been indulging in. But seriously, folks, we look at the campaign and the choice as it really comes down to voting for, well, Satan or other than Satan. But I should correct that. It's not just voting for other than Satan. If you're voting for anyone other than Kamala Harris, like Jill Stein or, God knows, RFK still on the ballot, if you vote for those guys, you're voting for Trump. Kamala Harris is not perfect, but she's not Satan either. And since we last spoke to you, the Donald has been, well, he's really outdoing himself. Because he alleges Kamala Harris never worked in a McDonald's. He thought the best way to counter that, that would be to create a photo op in a McDonald's. So they secured a McDonald's, kicked everybody out of it, put their people to drive through the drive-thru windows, and turned Donald Trump loose at the fry machine by virtue of the fact that the supposed restaurant employee Trump neglected to wear a hairnet or don gloves or use any other of the precautions that would be normal, I think, in a McDonald's. In doing so, he adds yet another thing among the multitude of things that he's simply incompetent at. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from Robert Reich on that very topic. But before we go there, we also have to address the fact that our demented former president distinguished himself by making reference to, and this is really hard to believe in a political campaign, but he made reference to the, shall we say, manhood of the late golfer Arnold Palmer. Apparently, in the shower room, after some rounds of golf, Trump was a witness to the naked bodies of some of his fellow golfers, including Mr. Palmer, and evidently was, I guess you'd say, impressed. And of course, being Donald Trump, he thought it was appropriate to share that experience with the voting public. But I must say, it gives me no small twinge of pleasure to note that after hearing about this incident, porn star Stormy Daniels, remember her, to come forward with a four-word summary of the whole thing, which was, "He's no Arnold Palmer." And thank you, Ms. Millen, for digging up that little riff from King Missile's legendary detachable penis. Oh, and by the way, there was also a great line somebody came up with in reference to the appearance as a fry cook of Donald J. Trump. Not at. Some wag posed the question, I thought McDonald's already had a clown. And speaking of clownish behavior, a couple of days ago, I need to, I think, read you some direct quotes of what the Donald had to say at a campaign rally, which was as follows. The one thing I can't get used to is hydrogen. You know the story with hydrogen. It's great until it blows up, in which case, you're not recognizable. Even guys, strong guys like this, at this point, I guess Trump points to someone in the crowd, they call your mom or your wife. Is it a mom or, oh, look at that. Oh, I know them. Very wealthy parents. That's nice. Try to stick with the program, Grandpa. You know, I know them. No, your kids wouldn't be recognizable. That's not a good thought. How's my son doing? Well, he tried the new hydrogen. Does this sound like someone who is compos mentis? Anyway, something that continues to stun Mr. McMillan and I is the fact that when they poll potential voters, Trump scores well on the notion that he'd be better, perhaps, than Kamala Harris might be, because he's a businessman. And this might be a good place to hear from Robert Reich on that very subject.
Trump's entire candidacy is based on a lie.
I'm really a good businessman. I'm so good at business. Oh,
not true. Trump is a business failure. Almost every business he's touched, he's driven into the ground.
When it comes to great steaks, I've just raised the stakes. Trump steaks are the world's greatest steaks, and the Sharper Image is the only store where you can buy them.
According to Sharper Image's then CEO, they literally sold almost no steaks.
Trump had a failed board game.
My new game is Trump, the game.
Trump, the game, because it's not whether you win or lose, it's whether you win.
A failed bicycle race called Tour de Trump. A failed football team.
It's gonna stay strong. It's gonna stay strong for a long time.
Trump decided it was a good idea to start a mortgage company in 2006.
It's a great time to start a mortgage company.
That failed in less than 2 years. Let's see, what else was there?
Whatever happened to Trump Airlines?
Oh, that was a good one. One of his planes had a crash landing within the first 2 months, which he insisted was the most beautiful landing you've ever seen. The business failed within 3 years.
How about Trump University?
Failed.
And then there's Trump Magazine.
Failed.
Trump Vodka.
Failed.
Trump Travel, Trump Ice, Trump Network.
Failed, failed, failure. Trump has even managed to bankrupt multiple casinos. How do you lose money running a casino? There's an old joke that the easiest way to make a small fortune is to start with a large one. And that's exactly what Trump did. Multiple analyses show that if Trump had simply invested his multi-million dollar inheritance in an index fund and didn't touch it, he'd be a lot richer than he is now. Now think about that. His entire life's work has been less successful than if he'd done nothing. And when he was president, Trump ran the country like he ran his failed businesses. He added $8.4 trillion to the national debt, largely through his tax cuts for the rich and big corporations. Trump has managed to survive every one of his business failures by leaving other people on the hook, leaving workers unpaid, shafting his investors. The whole idea that Trump is good at business was a carefully crafted illusion, concocted for a reality TV show. And like a lot of reality TV shows, we've come to learn it was all show and no reality. The only business Trump has been successful at is conning people. Now he's trying to do it again. Don't fall for it.
Something else we probably shouldn't fall for is Trump's new ideas about how he's going to fix things. Like with tariffs. We made passing mention in last week's program, a discussion with my high school poli-sci teacher, Mark Mattingly, about the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which made the economics of the Great Depression worse. This is worth a minute review, I think. The act and the tariffs imposed by America's trading partners in retaliation are described as major factors in the reduction of American exports and imports by two-thirds during the Great Depression. Economists and economic historians have a consensus view that the passage of the Smoot-Hawley tariff worsened the effects of the Great Depression. Now, apparently, if you're a monetarist economist, such as Milton Friedman, you poo-poo the idea that that was the major reason that the Depression was as bad as it was. And frankly, I'll leave that up for you economists to argue about. But I did like this quote from Wikipedia about how the tariff bill had originally been opposed. Notes Wikipedia. In May 1930, a petition was signed by 1,028 economists in the U.S. asking President Hoover to veto the legislation. Automobile executive Henry Ford spent an evening at the White House trying to convince Hoover to veto the bill, calling it an economic stupidity. While J.P. Morgan's chief executive, Thomas W. Lamont, said he almost went down on his knees to beg Hoover to veto the asinine Hawley-Smoot tariff. The piece notes that while Hoover joined the economists in opposing the bill, calling it, quote, vicious, extortionate, and obnoxious, unquote, because he felt it would undermine the commitment he'd pledged to international cooperation, he eventually signed the bill after yielded to influence from his own Republican Party. Also his cabinet, who had threatened to resign, and also business leaders. In short, it got signed and did a lot of harm. But it certainly would seem that Donald Trump has not read the Wikipedia entry describing what happened regarding Smoot Hawley. There's more things we could say about what Donald Trump imagines our economic realities. Piece by Kevin Drum, writing in jabberwocking.com, noted that Trump is full of stories about his negotiating prowess, while most of them are fiction. And even the ones based on a grain of truth are twisted and exaggerated to fit his standard heroic narrative. Often it's noted no one's even negotiated the thing before Trump showed up. Why? Because, well, they're stupid. His stories invariably involve crude threats, and then the other side then caves, usually by calling up Trump. Never because Trump called them. There were seven examples listed in the article. I'm just going to cite the final two. Regarding Central American countries refusing to accept deported criminals. Said Trump, the generals told me, sir, we can't bring them back. The countries won't accept MS-13 gang members. They won't accept them. And I said, really? How much do we pay these various countries in terms of economic aid? Tell them they're in default. They're delinquent. We're not paying them anymore because they won't accept it. And you know what happened? They called me, every one of them. They said, we'd be honored to take them back, sir. We'd be honored. It was so easy. The reality? Trump did cut off aid to several Central American countries, but it was because he wanted them to halt the flow of outbound migrants. It had nothing to do with deportations. Aid was restored after reaching normal agreements a few months later. Nobody called Trump begging for relief. Regarding the Taliban, as told by Wesley Hunt, during those negotiations, Trump told Taliban leaders that he would kill them. If you harm a hair on a single American, prompting the translator present with them to appear stunned, and Trump goes on, tell him, just tell him what I said. Trump then reached into his pocket, pulled out a satellite photo of the leaders of the Taliban's home and handed it to him, got up, and walked out of the room. The reality? There's no record of this happening. The real story is Trump was so desperate to withdraw from Afghanistan, he negotiated an epically bad deal. Drum notes at the summary at the end that it's worth noting that it's widely agreed that Trump is historically a very poor negotiator. Early in his career, he massively overpaid for a USFL team, as you just heard from Robert Reich. Also the Eastern Shuttle, the Plaza Hotel, and his Atlantic City casinos. Then he went bankrupt. Since then, he's overpaid for golf courses and hotels, which is why they make little or no money for him. His recent income has come mostly from The Apprentice and from licensing and management deals. And speaking of The Apprentice, here's what MSNBC had to report on the op-ed in U.S. News from John D. Miller, who said, we created a monster. Trump was a TV fantasy invented for The Apprentice.
Joining me now is John D. Miller, former chief marketer for our sister network, NBC. This week, he wrote in U.S. News and World Report about his regret leading the team that marketed The Apprentice. Also joining me is Tim O'Brien, senior executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion and an MSNBC political analyst and pal of the show. Thank you both for being here. It's great to meet you, Mr. Miller. I want to read you to yourself. I'm going to read you to you. You wrote this. You wrote, we created a monster. Trump was a TV fantasy invented for The Apprentice. At NBC, we promoted the show relentlessly. Thousands of 30-second promo spots that spread the fantasy of Trump's supposed business acumen were beamed over the airwaves to nearly every household in the country. The image of Trump that we promoted was highly exaggerated. In fact, Trump declared business bankruptcy four times before the show went into production, and at least twice more during his 14 seasons hosting. The imposing boardroom where he famously fired contestants was a set because the real boardroom wardroom was too old and shabby for TV. I also learned from working with him that he has questionable judgment. At the wrap party for The Apprentice season 3, he pitched an idea for the upcoming season. This is wild. He told me we should make a team of black players compete against white players. My first thought was, WTF.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the way that that Trump was in reality versus the Trump that people saw on the show.
Well, what you see right now is sort of what he was in reality. He was, to a large degree, someone who was an entertainer. He really was not a good businessman. Our job is, from a marketing perspective, for the conceit of the show, was to make it seem like he was a legitimate businessman, competent, good judgment, compassion when needed. Mm-hmm. None of those things were actually apparent, but that's what we had to do to make the show work. And so we created that narrative, made it seem like it was money, like he was living in royalty,
yeah,
with the cars and the limousines and the helicopter all labeled Trump, in golded, gilded, like the gilded New York age, and then had to position him as a great potential CEO.
Yeah.
And I say potential because he never really was a
That's
CEO.
Right.
He was a lot of little businesses that he had.
Yeah.
But they were, to make the show work, we had to make it seem like that. And unfortunately, that, because we just pummeled American with those messages,
yeah,
that remains there right now. And to many people, even though there is significant things that you can see right now that is that where that's not true, many people think it is. And right now with the economy being one of those things that people are looking at, we made him seem to be a very smart businessman.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, that is not true, because he wouldn't have 4 bankruptcies and then ultimately 6 during the time of Apprentice if he was that good.
Right. And I mean, look, Mark Cuban is on a TV show, but that's because he's judging other businesses and he's a very successful,
yes,
businessman and really genuinely rich. But Tim, we've talked about this a lot. Donald Trump was not as rich as he said he was.
Right.
He was definitely not that successful. His company was just a little series of LLCs. He doesn't even own most of the buildings with the word Trump on them. Talk about the real Donald Trump. And what do you think was the damage done by people really genuinely believing that Trump really was successful?
Well, I mean, I think The Apprentice was his ticket into the White House.
Absolutely.
But prior to The Apprentice, he was this punchline of jokes about the excesses of the 1980s. He was out in the tundra. No one did big deals with him. He was an afterthought on comedy shows. He was this sort of subject of ridicule, and New Yorkers knew him as like one of the sort of dirigibles you float above the city as a feature of New York life. But he wasn't a major real estate developer. The real estate community shunned him. And he had this very fortunate intersection with Mark Burnett. Mm-hmm. And Mark Burnett, who was an immigrant, was selling blue jeans in California and read Art of the Deal. And it was like his Bible to the American dream. And he always thought, he told me this, that he would one day do a show that embodied the spirit of the Art of the Deal. But remember, the Art of the Deal itself is a book. It's a nonfiction,
yeah,
work of fiction.
That Trump didn't even write.
He didn't even write it, and the whole thing is full of errors and mythologizing and presenting him as a great deal maker when he wasn't a great deal maker. He routinely got taken to the cleaners by other deal makers. He overpaid, he went into debt,
yeah,
he went into bankruptcy, and then The Apprentice rolls around via Mark Burnett, and he gets recreated as this entrepreneurial guru to the masses, when in fact he was a serial bankruptcy artist. As you know, as John noted, his real office in Trump Tower was like this relic of the 1980s. Shag carpeting, you know, crummy furniture.
I heard the exact same thing when I wrote my book, Man Who Sold America. I interviewed somebody who was a contestant on one of the seasons of The Apprentice who said it was kind of shocking to see how shabby the boardroom was in the real Trump Tower.
And he still wears the same suits and ties and shirts that he wore in that
that
era.
Are down to his knees,
yeah,
like he's a church deacon from the 1980s.
Yeah, like baked in amber,
yeah,
of that era. And I think that the myth of him being an unusually gifted businessman is what sold him to voters,
yeah,
in 2016.
Yeah, and they still do. You still hear people say, well, I'm going to vote for him because he's a businessman, understands, yeah, the economy.
But going back to the casting, the reason that Donald Trump got cast, because almost no other CEO would do it. They did have,
right,
a thought of doing some with other CEOs.
Sure. Because they didn't have the time, because they had real jobs and money.
Right.
And dignity.
Yeah, he had, well, he
and
had
he needed the money, right?
He at that point, because he was bankrupt, yes. And he made most of his money off the integrations of the shows. And the black versus white thing, when he told me about that, I basically had to think about how do I do it, because you don't want to make him mad. But the right. same token, I had to say, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
So what I did was I said, I can see why you think that would be a noisy idea, because everybody would be talking about it. Right. Headlines everywhere.
The idea that he thought it would prove some sort of racial superiority of white people?
That probably was.
For
and
sure.
then I said, you're going to lose money because you make most of your money off the integrations, and there's not going to be a company that's going to want to touch that.
And what would he have done if the black team had won? He probably would have had a complete meltdown. The other piece about it is that he's also... He benefits from a level of sycophancy that I think most people can't imagine ever having to deal with in their real life. This is Stephen Miller, the architect of his child separation policy, commenting on his performance at the Al Smith dinner. That was the single best comedy performance of any president or candidate for president in history. But what made his comedy set even more extraordinary was that the jokes were politically devastating for Kamala. He absolutely crushed the Democrats tonight. He did the same thing about the Bloomberg interview, the disastrous Bloomberg interview in which he couldn't even explain tariffs. And he said it was the greatest live interview any political leader or politician has done on the economy in our lifetimes, period. I mean, he has people doing that for him all the time.
Because to survive in his orbit,
you
have to kiss the ring.
Yeah.
And he tends to attract C-minus people.
That guy definitely is that.
Yeah, and I think, in both his business life and political life, he has never had first-rate people who are much sought-after talents. What he has are people who either think they can take advantage of him, they usually are proven wrong, or they're people who are just sub-level and they think that they can get into the spotlight and ride his coattails, and they know to stay there, they've got to
kiss
bend
them.
The knee, kiss the ring.
He is the single most easy person to manipulate that I've ever worked with.
Wow.
And quite honestly, the easiest thing, he has an unfillable hole for compliments. People that would make anybody blush and say, oh, no, too much, that never happens to him. So you can do it in grand doses, and when you do that, he is, you're a genius.
Yeah.
And called me many times a genius. I'm a good marketer. I don't know if I'm a genius.
Yeah.
But then if you disagree with him, you're an idiot.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm an idiot either.
Yeah.
Maybe not somewhere in between.
Yeah.
But quite honestly, it was black or white with him.
Yeah. And he does it now where he, to try to explain, he tries to say, well, no one wants to work with Kamala Harris and no one wants to work with her. But most of the people who worked with him don't want anything to do with his new campaign. But he says, oh, well, they were terrible people. I fired them because they were awful. Right. Like he can never.
Yes.
And the fact is she's attracted to her campaign some of the best political
Liz
operatives
Cheney,
in,
Dick
the,
Cheney,
in the country and Republicans.
So absolutely.
That math doesn't work.
Did it surprise you when the gimmick that made him famous made him president, that he became president?
Yes. Well, it was less surprising than disturbing because I knew I was complicit in it.
Yeah.
And that was difficult to do. And the reason that I'm coming forward now, first of all, I was an executive for a long time, and I really couldn't speak up at that point. I retired a couple of years ago. And then I said, a few weeks ago, I said, what can I do? And I said, I have to tell this story, because I hope it's not too late, but I helped pull the wool over America's eyes towards a guy that should not be president, should never be president, and should be fired from the whole thing.
You know who says the same thing? Tony Schwartz, the guy who really wrote Art of the Deal.
And Tony has a lot of guilt about it.
And he said exactly the same thing, sitting exactly where you're sitting on this set. John D. Miller, thank you so much.
Unfortunately, we must, at this juncture, take a short break. Stand by for more Stephen J. Harper and Nancy Yamada. They're both going to be worth your time to hear. So stick around. This is Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.